Every Tuesday on 89.3 FM at 1 p.m. Also available on iTunes Podcast and Google Play Music. On your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
I'm Kamaya.
I'm Amira.
I'm Kaya.
I'm Kamaya.
And you're listening to WPFW, Washington.
Watch and comment for Tuesday, October 26th. I'm Dave Rabin. It's great to be with you. I hope you're enjoying this wonderful fall weather. And I just want to thank you all so much for your support during our fundraising drive. We are only here because of you. We really appreciate your support for this wonderful Jazz and Justice resource. That is WPFW. Thank you so much. And I'm sure you're glad that I'm not going to be asking for the do-re-mi from you today. And you're glad, and I'm glad, and on with the show. In a few minutes, we're going to speak with Georgetown University Law School's Kristen Henning, author of The Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth, a really important interview with a wonderful professor at Georgetown Law. But first, a live theater is coming back to D.C. And one example is the Expax Theaters, which is presenting Pancrack 45 by Czech playwright Martina Kinska. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. The play is set at the infamous Pancrack prison in Prague, in the summer of 1945, just weeks after the Nazi defeat at the end of World War II. A short period of liberation euphoria is soon followed by a turbulent time of revenge and retribution, big time, big time. People had suffered for a number of years under the Nazi occupation of Prague and of Czechoslovakia. Nazis and traitors are prosecuted. Public executions are happening daily. Sharing one prison cell while awaiting their trial are five women accused of Nazi collaboration. Each of them has to testify knowing the gallows are waiting. This is for real, folks. This is not some HBO whatever. This is for real. Based on historical material, the play confronts questions about guilt, revenge, betrayal, trust, and most importantly, arguably, survival. Pancrack 45, in partnership with the Embassy of the Czech Republic, opens this Thursday. It's 2 days away and runs through November 21st at the Atlas Performing Arts Center in the heart of the vibrant H Street Corridor in Northeast D.C. in our fair city. We're joined now by Karin Rozenczyk, Expat Theater founder and co-director of Pancrack 45. Welcome to WPFW and to Community Watch and Comment.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
It's really great having you. And so tell us about Expat Theater. You're a pretty new theater company here in D.C.
Yes, I founded it in 2019, primarily with the aim of bringing international plays to D.C., mostly plays that are by contemporary playwrights and haven't been translated or are in translation. Plays that deal with issues that burn for everybody, actually, global issues, cultural issues, and we want to offer a different perspective maybe to some of the predicaments that we are having today in our world. And Pancrack 45 is the third production of Expat Theater. And again, you know, it's a play with international politics is involved, culture is involved. and five women are involved sitting in a prison cell.
Right. I mean, I saw an earlier production of yours, and I think it was entirely a women as well. So you've got a feminist streak and an international streak, and very importantly, I think a historical streak. I think it's important to understand and to remember what went on. I mean, just in preparing for this interview, just I didn't know the history of, you know, in particular the Nazi occupation of Czechoslovakia. Pretty horrific. The Nazis invaded Czechoslovakia, I think even before the advent of World War II in 1939.
Yes, it was in March 39. Yes.
And yeah. Yeah.
A lot of people,
I mean,
argue
that was kind of.
Sorry.
That was the whole Munich.
Exactly.
Yeah. In 1938, and peace in our time, which didn't exactly happen.
Exactly. Yes.
Where the British Prime Minister went to Munich, and it's often referred to as, a caving in to dictators. But some Czechs responded to that occupation by collaborating. Others resisted. Same thing happened in France and elsewhere in Europe during the war. And the play takes place in the famous Pankrac prison in Prague, which I haven't been yet. I'm kind of saving it, but Prague is, I think, was not bombed during the war, and it's supposed to be absolutely gorgeous. So
actually,
you've probably
bombed.
Been there.
It was mistakenly bombed even by the U.S., and this is not a joke. They thought it was Dresden, but they bombed Prague.
They thought it was Dresden?
Yes, yes.
No kidding.
Yes.
But they didn't destroy it. I mean, they didn't.
No,
They didn't bomb the heart of it.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, that's a bit of a sidebar. So, the play takes place in Prague, after the end of the war. Five women in the same jail cell awaiting trial and the possibility of being executed, all accused of collaborating, with the Nazis. But that's where the similarity ends. Talk about these women. They're all accused of collaborating with the Nazis, but they're quite different from each other. If you could talk about, just give people a sense of who they are, and that's kind of the grist of the play, if you will, the difference between these women.
Yeah, there are five women. Two of them are actresses, and their way of collaboration was to sleep with the Nazi nomenklatura. One of them was actually a lover of Joseph Goebbels, the propaganda minister. The other one had several affairs with people in the film department that was also led by the propaganda minister. So it was basically completely directed by the Nazis. One was a resistance member, and she survived the Operation Anthropoid when the top Nazi, Reinhard Heydrich, was assassinated and everybody else died or was killed by the Nazis because one of them went to betray them all. And so she's accused because she's suspected of having been a traitor too, which is basically not true, but she's the only one who survived. And why did she survive? Because she slept with a Gestapo officer to save herself and her husband, among other things. And then there is one person called Julie, who is a composite. She's the only fictional character. She's a Jewish person. She's there in the beginning, already in the cell waiting for them. And we don't know what her agenda is, but she probably has one. And then there's another one who is the wife of a top Nazi in the Czech Republic, but her name is not revealed until the middle of the play. So all these five women have been complicit. And the moral of the play, if you will, is that you don't have a pure hero who fights for the resistance and a pure evil person who is on the side of the Nazis, but it's really about the shades of gray and about how you cannot possibly be uninvolved if a system like this enters your country, you will do things that you may not have thought you would do, because the system forces you to do so. And everybody does save somebody, a wife, a daughter needs a job, and so on. And so the point is, we've all probably have the evil beast in us. And in order to not have that come out, we need a functioning democracy.
Boy, that sounds kind of relevant to our current state of affairs. Yes. A certain party in our country, a major party, will do anything to survive.
Yeah. We picked that time really carefully.
I mean, so people might think that this play is kind of obscure and irrelevant. It is not. Yes. I mean, it's historically fascinating, I believe, but it's also extremely relevant because, we have, ample example of people in this country doing, whatever they think they need to do in order to survive in a certain political climate created by a, political person who shall remain nameless. And that's why
we have history that should teach us something. And that's why we, use these things to let people know that similar structures have existed and there is a choice.
Yes.
Comes down to the voting.
And, it used to be that theatrically and artistically, D.C. was considered a backwater, at least compared to New York City. But people that are creating theater like the X-Mac Theater, like our guest today, are putting the lie to it. I think we're becoming a theatrical center. And I just want to thank you so much for joining us. You have panel discussion during your run. You have, you're not going to be in the dark. There's going to be a supporting program notes and, all kinds of support.
Let me just tell everybody that the tickets are on atlasarts.org or expatstheater.com. These are two most important marketing messages that I wanted to send out.
Yes. I mean, I think it's very important to, support, this production and theater in general in DC. I mean, we're coming out of a very difficult, period, obviously, with the pandemic, and we need to support the arts here and, elsewhere in our country. So please support one more time. Give it's expats, like expatriates, expats theater.
Expatstheater.com.
And you can also go to the Atlas Performing Arts Center website for tickets. And the play opens this Thursday. It runs through November 21st at the Atlas Performing Arts Center in the heart of the vibrant 8th Street Corridor in Northeast D.C. You can make a wonderful evening of it. Have a bite before or after a drink. It's a very exciting reemergence of that whole corridor. So please support this production and support of the arts here in D.C. Karen Rodnizek, Expat Theater founder and co-director of Pancrack 45. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, too, David.
Really appreciate it. It's great having you. Be well.
Likewise. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And on to our next guest. We are just flooded with wonderful women here this morning on WPFW. George Floyd's killing by a Minneapolis policeman last year spurred an outcry against police violence towards people of color in this country and around the world. It didn't just get a reaction here in the United States. And coming out of this increased concern, a new report by the Associated Press looks at thousands of cases of adolescents being treated forcibly by the police. Half of the kids were black, although they make up just 15% of the population. I mean, I know numbers are can be a bit numbing, but half of the kids apprehended and dealt with forcibly were black, even though black kids represent 15% of the population. What exactly is leading to this outrageous disparity, and what can be done about it? Joining us to unpack this crucial question and related questions is Georgetown University's Law School's Kristen Henning, criminal defense attorney with 25 years of experience in D.C.'s juvenile courts. This is not some ivory tower professor. This is someone who has really been in the trenches. Ms. Henning is the author of a new book, The Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth. Kristen Henning, welcome to Community Watch and Comment.
Hello. Thank you for having me, David. I look forward to talking with you today.
It's really great having you. And I want to get a, I want to talk to Ms. Henning, and I want to hear from listeners. I hope you chime in. I'm sure you have some stories to tell related to the topic that we're going to be discussing today. We're at 202-588-0893. We'd love to hear from you. It's such an important topic to be discussing today. So so I was kind of caught by the title of your book, The Rage of Innocence, and I said, that's a reference to something. and it is in fact a reference, I believe, maybe I'm mistaken in terms of why you chose it, but there's a book by the wonderful American novelist Edith Wharton, The Age of Innocence, written in 100 years ago, actually. I don't know if you know this. And she got the Pulitzer Prize for it.
Right.
and she's the first woman to win it. So my question, Ms. Henning, is this a subtle ploy to, you know, for a Pulitzer, or what's going on here?
Yeah, not at all. but certainly, I wouldn't walk away from the Pulitzer. So let's not, you know, above, you know, women to women, conversation. And of course, you know, there is the subtle play on the age of innocence and the idealism, you know, of innocence in Western society. But, you know, really, you know, the rage of innocence is the rage that I want all of us to have when any one child is deprived of the opportunity to be a kid and to enjoy the privileges of innocence. But, you know, the book also, the title also has more subtle references, right? The rage of innocence is also what happens when we repeatedly tell black children over and over again that they are bad, that they are criminal. And so, like any of us, we are built to resist those labels, right? So we push back. We reject this categorization and really this dehumanization. And so black children speak out. And, you know, they assert their innocence wherever they can. And unfortunately, you know, it leads to a vicious cycle sometimes where the officers perceive that pushback, that assertion of self-esteem and self-worth. They see that as a threat. And so it just further perpetuates unfairly the criminalization of black children.
Indeed. I mean, one example that I can't avoid talking about, and it's not an example of the pushback, but it's just so horrific. I feel like I'd be remiss in not bringing up is the story of the tragic story of Tamir Rice in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't have a chance to push back. First of all, he was 12, I believe.
Yes.
And I think that the policeman killed him within 2 seconds.
Correct.
Of arriving. If you could just refresh people about that. I mean, it's so awful. And the kid was doing what kids do. He was just playing.
Yes.
He was playing in a park.
Yes.
And the, you know, I believe anyway. I mean, if you could just talk about that. It's just so horrific.
Absolutely. So, you know, this book is, you know, dedicated to Tamir Rice and all of the Tamir Rices out there. Tamir was 12-year-old black boy in Cleveland, Ohio, at a recreation center, getting some much needed outdoor time, doing what kids do, playing with a toy gun. Toy guns are part and parcel of American folklore forever, right? This is what kids do, boys and girls. And he's out there, and someone calls the police, calls 911, and says there is a black male with a gun, probably fake. Even then, they recognize that it was probably fake. And the officers who received the call raced to the scene. And in less than 3 seconds, Tamir is shot dead. And as you said, didn't even have a chance to respond. And there was no indication that the little bitty video clips that we have indicate that he was just beginning to raise his hand. He wasn't even pushing back. Or resisting. And what's so powerful about that story is that when the police officers were interviewed about why they shot him and why they shot him so fast, they kept saying that he looked older than he actually was. They kept talking about his extra large jacket, his size 36 pants, and they insisted that they just didn't recognize his 12-year-old face. And research shows that those officers were not alone, that many people see black children as older than they actually are. There's a
something
fact,
like 4.5 years
yes,
than they are.
That's right.
Right.
Yep. Fabulous study by Philip Atiba Goff and his colleagues finding that, just as you said, both police officers and civilians perceive black children to be 4.5 years older than they actually are. That's a profound impact. Has a profound impact on how we treat children, our willingness to use force without empathy, our willingness to not see, or our inability, I should say, to not see normal childhood play when they encounter a young person. And it also affects how we treat children once they are arrested and brought into the court system. We treat them like adults and not like the children that they are.
Right. I mean, there's so many takeaways, I think, from that horrific story, including just, I don't think that the police officer was seriously punished, and he had a questionable record coming into his job, and he pulled up within a few feet of Tamir, and there's no engagement. What about, hey, officer, what about pulling up at a relatively safe distance and trying to figure out what's going on? You know, get behind your armored door,
right?
And figure out what is engage this child and a 12-year-old. I mean, it's just impossibly awful. And instead, he pulls up in a few feet and just shoots. I mean, I think the message didn't get to him that the 911 caller had said that it might be a toy gun. I don't think he got that message,
right.
But it really doesn't make
it
any
doesn't
difference.
Matter. Yes.
It doesn't matter. You don't, you know, what about, you know, some kind of practice, some kind of procedure for protecting this, I guess, for lack of a better word, suspect. You don't know what's going on. Why don't you try and do it where you can't claim that you're protecting yourself?
Right.
I mean, it's a model, a horrific model of, you know, police practice gone completely, you know, the lack of police practice.
Yes. And I have to say, you know, a lot of people, you know, who listen to me, for example, talk, just as you just spilled out there, the story, you know, want to say, well, you're Monday morning quarterbacking. You know, you're not out there on the street making these split second decisions. But the reality is really, and this is what I drive home in this book, is that we do make different choices when we are dealing with white children. And so the, you know, research shows that our racial biases are more likely to kick in when we have to make these split second decisions. So it's extra important to slow down. And as you said, the Tamir Rice case, especially, they really had ample opportunity to park at a safe distance, you know, hide out behind the door, like you say, and I write about in the book, and call out and engage in questions. And I got to tell you, if they had seen a white girl with pigtails playing on that gazebo in Cleveland, there's no way. There's no way. They would have approached it differently. And I think that's just factual. It's not Monday morning quarterbacking or supposition. And it's also supported by the empirical research on racial bias.
You know, and there's all kinds of studies that, you know, on a certain level, we're all racist on a certain level. You probably know Ava Patterson out in California. We were talking about this, when I interviewed her, just a wonderful lawyer and constitutional lawyer. I would assume that you know of her. And she was just making the point that, you know, on a certain level, we're all racists, white and black. I mean, that doesn't let whites off the hook. When all people are shown slides of black faces, you know, and whether they would pull the trigger, you know, everybody's pulling the trigger faster on a black face. I mean, it's like we are in just, you know, totally overwhelmed, imbued, whatever the right verb is, in a racist society.
Yeah, you know, and like people don't like the word racist because they think it's polarizing. So I like to explain it this way, that the narrative, this narrative of fear about black children has become so deeply embedded in the American psyche that even those folks who are deeply committed to democratic principles, racial equity, and the like still have those fears. And it operates within the same race as well as across race. And, you know, so the racism piece comes from the historical evolution, right? And that America has a very long history of not seeing black children as children. So from the time of slavery, obviously black children were perceived to be the property of the purported slave master. Then you get to the civil rights era and you have an 14-year-old Emmett Till who can be lynched as a symbolic statement that white America will not tolerate integration, right? And so, and it's really important that, as you talked about earlier, that the lynchers can exist without punishment. And they do so by justifying their behavior by demonizing black children like Emmett Till, by painting Emmett Till as a threat to all of white America and to white women in particular. That was very intentional then, right? And then even in the 80s and the 90s, when we reached the super predator myth, there was an uptick in crime, in violent crime, and black children in particular, black boys became the target in the war against crime and a war against poverty, right? And black children were, again, very intentionally demonized for political gain. Now, even as we move beyond those critical errors in history, the narrative that was intentionally told about black children now lives in American society in our subconscious existence, right? And right. That's why we can have, whether you're racist or not today, whether you intentionally, despise black children or not, you still have these deeply embedded fears about black kids.
Whether you know it or not. And I think part of the problem is, you know, as a privileged white male, quite frankly, I mean, it's an eye opener in your book and I'm, you know, certainly, gotten it elsewhere. Just the incredible assault that African Americans and particular kids are subjected to on a daily basis. Right. I mean, I don't have the experience of walking down the street and, you know, what are you doing here? And let me see underneath your shirt. And, you know, I mean, and so, you know, so as a white privileged male, In a racially mixed neighborhood, no less, you know, right. I go like, what are these black kids so angry about? It's because I don't have the experience. And the only way that I know about it is trying to educate myself, but I don't personally have the experience of dealing with a racist society, and in particular a racist a police force. You know, I think stories are really important. You talk in your book about the story of Eric, the 13-year-old who makes the Molotov cocktail. If you could talk about that, it's such an instructive story.
Yeah, and I really wanted to comment on something. I'm happy to tell Eric's story, but just to comment, I really appreciate your point. You're saying that as a privileged white male, you didn't realize or have a full understanding. Why are black kids so angry? Why are they so angry at the police? And I can't tell you how many people have been shocked by what I talk about and what I share in the book, because it is so true. There are black children throughout the country, particularly in urban areas, who live in very heavily policed neighborhoods. And so literally, I have clients who tell me they can see a police officer multiple times a day. They can be stopped by officers, as you started to say, being asked where you're going from, where you're coming from, being asked to lift up their shirt so that an officer can see their waistband. All of this has a profound and traumatic impact on how Black youth perceive themselves and how they perceive law enforcement and how they relate to law enforcement. People have no idea just how frequent Black youth come into contact with the police when they're not doing anything at all in so many neighborhoods. And then the other aspect, so that's one way in which I think Black children are criminalized, through this hyper-surveillance. But then you asked me about Eric. And so Eric it really paints for us another way in which Black children are criminalized, and that is through the criminalization of normal adolescent behaviors. So Eric was a 13-year-old boy that I represented in Washington, D.C. And of course, you know, I've changed his name to protect confidentiality. But Eric was watching a movie on a Saturday night when he sees someone making a Molotov cocktail. In his 13-year-old mind, he says, I want to make something that looks like that. So he goes into the kitchen, he grabs a glass bottle, he begins to pour liquids into the bottle, pine saw, bleach, stainless steel cleaner, other liquids that we know won't catch on fire. Many of them are water soluble. This is my favorite part of the story, he grabs a piece of toilet paper and he runs the toilet paper from the inside of the bottle to the outside and puts on the cap. We also know there's no way that this this toilet paper can really serve as a wick. It's going to burn out before it even reaches the cap. So he's finished making his toy. He then throws it in his book bag to prevent it from spilling on his mother's white carpet. He forgets all about it. It's Saturday night. Monday morning, his mother drives him to school. He grabs his book bag. He puts it through the conveyor belt at school, and a school resource officer sees it and says, "What is this?" At which point he immediately says, "Oh, that's nothing. You can throw it away." He goes on to class, minds his own business. Next thing we know, police officers are showing up. The fire department is showing up, and he gets arrested and dragged out in front of all of his friends for some normal adolescent behavior. That began a 9-month adventure. That's really not the word. 9-month trauma in the local courthouse, where we were hiring expert witnesses to prove that it wasn't flammable, having evidentiary hearings. He got expelled from school. He got, excluded from all of his extracurricular activities. It was absolutely terrible. And let me end this story this way by telling you, some months later, I was giving a talk in New Haven, Connecticut, and I shared this story at that conference. And a white woman came up to me afterwards and she said to me, "My son did the exact same thing." And I said to her, "What happened?" At which point she said, "My son got placed in accelerated or advanced science classes." I mean, just the radical difference in that treatment and response and perceptions of adolescent behavior. So it's just so tragic. And it's just, that's how I opened the book, is with stories, you know, like that, to really help people see their own adolescence in these stories.
You've got to hear these stories. I mean, it's, it's crucial. It's just, you can't emphasize that enough. I should say, I'm speaking with Georgetown University Law School's Kristen Henning, 25 years experience in juvenile justice and the author of a new book, The Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth. It's so important for folks to hear this. A lot of folks, that are dealing with it on a daily basis aren't going to be surprised, but, for others, it's so important, to hear it. And, you know, we're talking about adolescents, and it should be emphasized, as you do in your book, that adolescents, you know, their brains are not fully formed. And they react in ways that aren't necessarily ideal. You know, things tend to escalate. These are kids that are under a tremendous amount of stress and trauma. If you could talk about that.
Yes. And what I love to emphasize is that white and black adolescence looks the same. And in fact, adolescence looks like adolescence all over the world, not just in the United States, but there have been studies demonstrating that the key features of normal adolescence look alike all over the world, regardless of race, ethnicity, class, geography. And so what do we know about teenagers? I could just do a poll and your listeners could call in and tell me. But teenagers are what? They're impulsive, emotional, reactive. They're sensation seekers. They test boundaries, test the limits. They're heavily influenced by their peers. They're fairness fanatics, all of these things. And so children, what does that mean? That means children do stupid things, right? And also children do things like, experimenting with drugs. And that's all children, white children. And there is national data, self-report data showing that white children, experiment with drugs, get into fights, all the things that we were, quote unquote, worry about as adults, but that white children do those things at the same rate and sometimes even higher rates than black children. Yet, as your data demonstrated at the beginning, David, you know, black kids are, you know, much, much more likely to end up in the criminal legal system. Children are suffering, black children in particular, are suffering from extraordinary trauma in being criminalized for what all other kids are allowed to do. And we see evidence, research is a growing body of really powerful research demonstrating the ways in which black children who experience frequent stops and frisks, or even who just live in heavily policed neighborhoods, experience high rates of fear, anxiety, depression, hopelessness. They're always hypervigilant, meaning they're always on guard, not trusting adults, particularly police officers. But that distrust of police sometimes translates over into other adult figures. There's evidence showing that black children who live in heavily policed neighborhoods have really poor sleep quality or high rates of insomnia. So, and also experience really questions about their own self-worth and whether it even makes sense to participate in mainstream society. So we're doing our young people a real disservice. And to be quite frank, we're doing society a disservice because none of this over-policing is improving public safety, right? You're causing stress.
On the contrary.
Exactly.
Right. I mean, it's arguably creating, you know, any more problems than it solves. So I just want to emphasize that black kids are no more dangerous or impulsive than white kids. I mean, that just think about that. That's, you know, arguably a shocker.
Yes.
For a lot of people because, you know, there's so much, you know, I guess for lack of a better word, propaganda to the contrary. And I think you also make the point that less than 1/10 of the arrests are for violent acts. I mean, if you could talk about that, that's
absolutely
extraordinarily important insight.
It really is. And I'm so glad you pulled that out, because really, people believe, given what we've seen, like the way, you know, call it propaganda, call it what you will, the media image and our now deeply embedded fears about Black children lead us to believe that Black children are not only criminal, but violent and dangerous. And what the data shows is that very few children of any race engage in the type of severe violent offenses that we are most afraid of, like murder, rape, aggravated assault, those and the like. And in fact, the vast majority, 80 and in some places 90% of arrests of young people is for low-level misdemeanor property offenses that do not involve any physical danger to another person. And so that's myth number one. And it is true. It is equally true for Black children as well, right? There is, the data doesn't bear out this claim that Black children are more violent than white children at all. And in fact, the most recent national data that I was able to find for the book show that only 9%, even of the arrests, right? This, you know, 9% of Black children arrested were arrested for a serious violent offense like that we've been talking about, the, you know, murder, rape, you know, harmful, violent offenses. It's just not true. But yet that's the narrative that gets told. And that's what causes so much fear.
You know, we're running short on time, I should say, in speaking with Georgetown University Law School's Kristen Henning, author of a new book. Do check it out, The Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth. I want to get to the solutions, the possible solutions that you offer in your book. But first, just real briefly, let's talk about what's motivating people to be so afraid. I mean, we've touched on it, but, you know, there's just this whole culture. I went and saw a simulcast opera on Saturday at a multiplex theater in Silver Spring, and I was concerned about whether they would have subtitles. My hearing's bad. Didn't know if we'd be able to. And I'm looking, well, if we can't enjoy the opera, you know, which was, by the way, it's amazing. It's based on Charles Blow's memoir.
Oh.
The New York Times column is,
yes. Interesting.
I do recommend it. It's quite an extraordinary in the Metropolitan Opera, you know, kind of an ivory tower institution is trying to break out of its elitist.
I'll have to check that out.
I mean, it's quite wonderful, but you know, I would just, as a backup, you know, seeing if there was something else that we could enjoy at the theater. And I realized that every other single alternative at that multiplex was violent. We're just in this bed of this sea of violence that is, you know, everywhere you look is in some level, conscious or otherwise encouraged by our culture. Talk about, people, why people predominantly but all of us are hotwired by certain kinds of stereotypes.
Yeah, so it's a great question. I mean, I think there are probably a number of ways we could talk about it, one of which is the research on cognitive brain functioning, right? Even for us, not just for the adolescents, which is that all of us operate with cognitive shortcuts. We get millions of pieces of information every single day, and so our brain helps us navigate life by creating shortcuts. And shortcuts include stereotypes and assumptions. We fill in missing pieces of data. So whenever you meet a new person, you automatically size them up by things like their physical appearance, their race, maybe even the first words out of their mouth, their dialect. You make assumptions right away. Those are cognitive shortcuts that allow us to sort of function throughout the day. Unfortunately, those cognitive shortcuts are sometimes negative, not always, but are sometimes negative. They are particularly negative about Black children. And they're particularly negative because of much of the history that I talked about, that we started with this intentionally negative, violent narrative about Black children in order to sustain or justify systems of supremacy and oppression. But even when we move out of that in history, we still are left with those subconscious fears that all of us have. So that's part of it. I think part of it is also, it is, and I think you sort of alluded to it, David, you talked about even, you know, being a you know, sort of a relatively privileged white male living even in a mixed neighborhood, you aren't in proximity to many young Black children who experience the type of trauma that I've been talking about or that I talk about in my book. And so what I like to say to many people is you just don't know what you don't know, right? You have no idea. So you're left to imagine, right? You're left in to fill in the gaps based on whatever data set is given to you by the media, by your friend. And maybe one friend got, you know, harmed or was a victim of a crime. That narrative lives in your head. And so if you don't have an opportunity to engage with young Black children, the vast majority of whom are wonderful and funny and creative and smart and productive. And guess what? They're just children too. So if you don't have those opportunities to engage on that level, you're stuck with the narratives that society has fed you. So I think, you know, as you started thinking about the solutions, part of the solutions for all of us is to figure out ways to get proximate, to get close to get to know, to engage with, whether it be by tutoring, by volunteering, whatever, by creating opportunities. If you're a legislative person, you know, creating opportunities to hear from the voices of young Black children, that's going to help us move at least somewhat towards the cultural shift that we need to undo that negative narrative about Black children.
Right. I mean, you're talking about a massive cultural shift here, yeah. and it's not going to happen overnight, but it's the kind of thing that is so necessary in order to you know, make something out of the killing of George Floyd and so many others. You know, I mean, this is an important moment. One little ripple. I don't know if you, I might have missed it if you mentioned it in the book, but I think there's another thing operating that I that's always kind of stuck in my brain. It's a quote from LBJ, and it goes something like, "If you can convince the lowest white man he's better than the best color man, he won't notice you picking his pocket. Hell, give him somebody to look down on, you know, right. Empty his pockets for you." Yeah. I mean, I just find that's a, you know, it's another element. You know, there's all these stories of immigrants, you know, coming to this country, like the Irish, you know, who were incredibly discriminated against when they arrived on our shores. And then they get established and then they're looking for somebody to look down on and, you know, and, problems, you know, obviously I don't want to make a blanket statement. I'm just using it as an example, but you know, to look down on African American because you're looking for someone to be superior to.
Yeah.
If you could just touch on that and then let's, in the time we have remaining, just talk about solutions.
Sure. So yes, I mean, so it is in the book. I talk about it briefly, at least in chapter 12. I believe it's chapter 8, but the chapter is called Policing by Proxy. And in that chapter, I talk about, I really want people to recognize that the criminalization of Black youth happens not only at the hands of, you know, of police officers in a blue uniform, but at the hands of all of us, right, in society who encounter a Black child on the street, at school, in the community, whatever, or wherever. And that's exactly the point, that civilians now, right, are in the business of policing Blackness or policing Black children, calling 911 or taking it in their own hands and killing Black children. So Trayvon Martin, right, killed by George Zimmerman, right? That story is very similar to what you describe. He's not actually white, right? He also is of mixed ethnic descent, but living in a gated community, right? And trying to protect his property, right? His claim, his entree into sort of this privileged class by being in that gated community. And so to have Black youth come and invade that community are perceived by him to be a threat. And, you know, again, like we could debate, and I don't even think it's worthy, but your point is really valuable, that intentionality played sort of that intentionality of subordinating a people, right, was really important historically in the Emmett Till story, right? And that during the civil rights era, poor whites were in partnership with white elites. And it made no sense, right? Because the desires and the interests that the white elite were advancing were not going to serve the white poor. And that the white poor should have been in partnership with Black Americans and people of color. But that didn't play out. And so
it's divide and conquer.
It's divide and conquer. And so when I come back to the, I think that's a wonderful precursor for how we think about the Trayvon Martin and the George Zimmerman scenario, right? Even if it's implicit, that it's that George Zimmerman didn't see himself in alignment with the Black young people who were coming into or visiting or moving into his neighborhood. That was a threat, but that's a part of that whole psyche. Right? That even if I am from an immigrant family or of some ethnic descent, if I can assimilate and pass and have the privileges, or try to reach the privileges of white America, then I'm going to side with them and demonize Black and poor. You know,
let's just quickly, we got about 3 minutes.
Sure.
And I do recommend that you, get Miss Henning's book. I think it's chapter 12.
Yes,
it's got the solutions. But let's give folks just what are you talking about? And we haven't touched on, I don't think at all or enough, you know, policemen in schools. I didn't experience that in suburban Boston growing up. But you've got largely in schools where we've got kids of color, you've got this prevalence of cops. What do you recommend? What are your ideas for how we can move in a different direction?
Yes, and I think schools are a perfect place to talk about solutions. Across the board, I talk about solutions in like three or four big buckets, and one of them is in radically reducing the footprint of police officers in the lives of children, period, and especially Black and brown children. And some of that has to start in schools. So thinking about the ways in which we can rely on police officers for what we most need them for and for what they are best trained to provide, and then relieving them of all of the other functions for which we don't need them or for which they can't do well. And one of them is with, you know, police in the school context. Police officers, the data and the evidence shows, are not well trained or adequately trained, some not at all trained, in working with teenagers, working with adolescents. So that's number one. They're certainly not trained to work with young people with special education needs, with mental health issues. And so part of my sort of second bucket of recommendations relates to investing in alternatives to public safety. Yes. Public safety, you know, through mental health providers, counselors, social workers, things of that nature is really, really important. And then finally, when police must come in contact with young people, they have to be trained, better trained. So trained on adolescent development, racial bias, de-escalation strategies, all of these things are critically important.
I want to get you back to just talk about that one subject and what's going on in the greater DC area, because you have so much wonderful experience in dealing with that. I can't thank you enough for all that you're doing and for joining us today. I've been speaking with Georgetown University Law School's Kristen Henning, author of a new book, which I can't recommend enough, The Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth. Thank you so much for joining us today. I can't thank you enough.
Thank you so much for having me, David. And thank you for elevating this important conversation. Thank you.
Really appreciate it. And that's going to do it for our show today. Thanks to our amazing engineer for her wonderful expertise. And coming up, we've got the WPFW news headlines. Don't forget the Blues Follows with the extraordinary Lady Murr. And listen to David Westone tomorrow. His guest is Cheryl Cashin, author of White Space, Black Hood, Opportunity, Hoarding, and Segregation in the Age of Inequality. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Dave Rabin. Be safe and have a good week.
From WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. The White House on Monday rejected two more of former President Trump's claims of executive privilege over documents requested by the Congressional Committee investigating the January 6 assault on the U.S. Capitol. White House counsel told the National Archives that President Biden has determined that Trump's effort to keep the records out of Congress's hands is not in the best interests of the United States. This comes after Trump filed a federal lawsuit seeking to block the committee from accessing records from his administration. Trump also insists that the records are protected by executive privilege, even though he is no longer president. Meanwhile, the National Archives gave Trump notice that it would be turning over the records he wishes to keep secret on November 12th, barring a court interference. A rare judicial inquiry began Monday into the death of Eric Garner, a 43-year-old black man who was killed in 2014 during an arrest for allegedly selling illegal cigarettes. NYPD officer Daniel Pantaleo put Garner in a chokehold. Garner told the arresting officers, "I can't breathe," more than 10 times before he became unconscious. He was left lying on the sidewalk as the cops waited for an ambulance to arrive and was later declared dead at the hospital. Pantaleo was fired for his actions 5 years later, but he never faced criminal charges. No new charges are expected as a result of the new hearing, which Garner's family sought and the city opposed for years. Garner's mother, Gwen Carr, says it's an opportunity for clarity and accountability. An FDA expert advisory panel is meeting today to discuss whether or not to approve the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine for children ages 5 to 11. The committee is reviewing research from Pfizer-BioNTech on trials in that age group to decide whether the vaccine's benefits outweigh its risks. If they decide it does, the FDA will then make the final decision about whether to authorize it. Once the FDA makes its authorization, the issue goes to the CDC's Vaccine Advisory Group, which is set to meet November 2nd and 3rd. If approved there, about 28 million children will become eligible for shots, and the pediatric vaccine could be available in the first or second week of November. Children in this age group would receive one-third of the adult dose given in two shots at least 3 weeks apart. So far, more than 6 million children have tested positive in the United States, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics. Children are far less likely than adults to be hospitalized with COVID-19 or suffer long-term consequences, putting a higher burden on the vaccines to prove safe and effective to justify their risks. And multiple Democratic lawmakers are calling to expel several of their Republican colleagues following reports they may have had an active role in planning the protests leading up to the January 6th insurrection. According to Rolling Stone, two organizers of the Stop the Steal rally said they took part in dozens of meetings with GOP members of Congress and White House staff ahead of the event. Representative Ocasio-Cortez tweeted on Monday that any member of Congress who helped plot a terrorist attack on our nation's capital must member of Congress who helped plot a terrorist attack on our nation's capital must be expelled. And in weather, in Washington, D.C., it is 62 degrees, mostly cloudy. In New York City,